The White House Farm case is one of the most notorious murder cases in modern English history. Depending on your view, it is either a classic example of tenacious police work or a horrific miscarriage of justice. Let's see if we can figure out this infamous and seemingly unsolvable whodunit.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Weird World Podcast. I am Carrie.
I'm Dean.
You are? Okay, Dean. And this is going to be a multi-part saga.
Yes. We're going to dive deep into this pretty famous case. It's a hugely famous case in England. And we should say up front, and I'll probably warn again at certain times, but there is definitely going to be some trigger warnings because there is violence against children.
Okay. So what are we thinking? Three or four parts?
We'll see.
Ish.
Let's play it by ear. Let's get started and see how it goes. I do. There is a lot of detail, but it is pretty interesting detail. And it's the kind of, I'm trying to stick just the detail that's important to try to figure out what happened in the case. Because, you know, there is a conclusion in the minds of some in England, but it's a very much an unclear case.
Okay. I feel like I've probably heard of this. It's not the Hinterkaifeck. Is it?
No, that was in Germany in the 1920s. Oh, okay. But, you know, Europe.
This is England in the
20th century. 1980s. 1985 is when it started, when it took place.
Then maybe I haven't heard of this.
Okay, well, let's go. So the Bamber family was kind of that almost stereotypical, well-to-do English farming family in Essex County. That's in the east of England. The home was called the White House Farm. It's about 8 miles south of Chelmsford in Middlesex and about 40 miles northeast of London. It's actually kind of Essex, kind of, I guess, sort of part of greater London now, but it's, you know, it's a ways away. It's kind of a semi-rural feel to it. And again, they had a very thriving and profitable farm there. They lived in a two-story Georgian-style house that was located just outside the little village of Tollesant Darcy in Essex County. That's to lay the geography there for you. I don't know.
Means nothing to me.
Patriarch of the family was named Ralph Neville Bamber. He was born in 1924. Everyone just called him Neville.
Okay.
He'd been a pilot in the Royal Air Force. He had married into the owners of the farm, the Speakman family, in 1949 by marrying June. She was also about 25 years old at the time. So he's this, you know, swashbuckling raft pilot. I don't know if he's very swashbuckling.
Or actually, a pirate.
I've heard both. But he's you know, he's not like that, actually. He's very staid, but he had a good reputation. He marries into this wealthy farming family in Essex.
Everybody liked the pilots back in those days.
Oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, the raft was got a lot of cred.
Yep.
And that marriage made him the owner of the very profitable 300-acre family farming operation, which also had some other real estate holdings as well around there. So he married into some significant wealth. He was tall and fit. He's kind of that, became this classic English gentry kind of a guy. Even though he married into this family, he fit it very well. Stayed stable, whereas June, his wife, was the opposite. She was highly religious and highly strong. And she viewed everything through this kind of lens of good and evil. She was sort of infamous for that. She was a very black and white person and very, very religious. This was exacerbated, though, by what I think we'd now call mental illness or something. I guess, what do we call that now, by the way? What do we call mental? We still call it mental illness? Okay. I'm just waiting for
If you have a mental illness,
the worst change all the time. So, but she was almost certainly mentally ill. Her affliction had shown itself not that long after they got married, and she had, for brief periods of time, been institutionalized for depression, psychosis, and paranoia. She had even undergone electroshock therapy.
Well, you know, back in those days, it could have been, you know, PMS or, you know.
You're going to have to trust me on this one. It was not.
A multitude of reasons could get you institutionalized.
That's
short of
absolutely
illness.
True. In this case, that's absolutely not what was happening. She was pretty unstable.
Okay.
There's no question.
Why did he marry her? He wanted the farm.
Probably, but at least according to what I read, she didn't really kind of exhibit this behavior until not that long after the marriage.
Okay.
So you're stuck.
Yeah.
In 1950 or whatever. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So Neville and June were unable to conceive children of their own, so they used some connections with the Anglican Church to adopt an infant in 1957. That little girl was named Sheila. She had been born in July 18 in 1957 to the daughter of a chaplain to the Archbishop of Canterbury. So the, yeah, I know. A senior chaplain to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the most important, you know, religious figure in the country, had a baby at 18 years old out of wedlock.
And so let's give her to the mentally ill mother.
Well, yes. And the daughter, by the way, was only 18 years old. So she was imposed upon to give the baby up for adoption immediately. And I guess she gave it to this, there was a church-run adoption society kind of thing. They took the kids in and they doled them out as they saw fit. The chaplain, the, I guess, grandfather of the child, he knew Neville from the Raft days. And so he got that deal done. And sort of, it sounds like Neville and June got pushed to the front of the line and they were able to adopt Sheila in 1957 in October.
Okay.
So let's learn a little bit about Sheila. She's going to be a pivotal character in this. We get to know the Bamber family here, in case you didn't know.
Well, currently she's an infant.
Yes, she is, but she's not going to stay that way. She will age.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's
like,
good.
Like most children. June routinely preached to Sheila and her brother Jeremy, who we'll meet in a moment, throughout their childhood. She was just, again, super religious. She would just preach and preach and preach. Eventually, though, Sheila started to rebel, and this put a really extreme strain on the relationship because Sheila would, you know, act out, and she would, it was weird. She'd become, eventually, you'll see here in a minute, hyper-religious kind of herself at times, but in her teen years, she'd sometimes rebel against that because she didn't get along with her mother at all.
Sure, and she was a normal adolescent, probably.
Sure, that's true. June overtly disapproved of Sheila's sometimes rebellious ways and would sometimes call Sheila evil and called her the devil's child.
That's not nice.
Once she found her sunbathing naked and just flew into a rage. Just freaked out. Like, you're the devil's child. Hey, get away from me, you monster.
Well, so that would probably be, what, in the 60s?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's hilarious. For sure.
Sheila, well, probably a little bit, probably in the 70s, actually, because she's born in 1957. I'm assuming she's a later teen, 15, 16 years old, something like that. So probably in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Sheila, at the age of 17, so I guess we're now 1974, got pregnant.
Uh-oh.
Her boyfriend was named Colin Caffell. He got her pregnant. The family did what, do you imagine?
I mean, probably flew into a
Well, I know, but what
tizzy.
Did they do? What did they want done with the child, the baby in her belly?
They wanted that baby born, and
you'd think that, wouldn't you? And give it up for adoption.
Or get married and keep it.
No, no. They arranged for an abortion.
Seriously?
Yeah, I know. I was a little surprised by that, too.
That's very surprising.
Very surprising, because especially how religious June was.
Yes.
But she was so
However, we know from the current climate in these United States, people are hypocrites.
Yes, they are. Sheila was a bit aimless. She did some modeling for a time.
But wait, did she have the abortion?
She had the abortion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now she's late teens. She's modeling a little bit. She modeled under the name Bambi.
Bambi Bam. What was the last name?
Bambi Bamber. Yeah.
Bamber.
I think just Bambi. One word. Okay. It's the mid-70s or so. She even traveled to Japan for a couple of months on a modeling gig. So she had some success as a model, but nothing, you know, she wasn't making a lot of money. So she tried her hand at things like hairdressing. She went to secretarial school, but nothing really stuck. She was sort of aimless. She didn't know what she wanted to do with the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. In May of 1977, she got pregnant again.
Oh, goodness.
It's still Colin, though. And this time she married boyfriend Colin Caffell. And this time she also kept the baby, but she had a miscarriage at 6 months into her pregnancy.
Well, so she didn't keep the baby.
She didn't get an abortion.
Okay.
Okay, Carrie, come on. Don't be so literal. The parents, hoping that it could help stabilize Sheila, they bought Colin and Sheila a little home in the Hampstead area of London. So you see, they had some a decent amount of wealth.
Yeah.
Sheila suffered another miscarriage not long after this, though, in their new home in Hampstead.
Poor Sheila.
Yeah. And the couple had a very tumultuous relationship. They fought, you know, again, Sheila is kind of, I know she's not biological, her mom, but she's raised like that. She was pretty high strung as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Colin was not great. He had affairs.
Yeah.
He was a philanderer. He started an affair not long after she got pregnant again. And her pregnancy was a little bit troublesome with the miscarriage. Yeah. So she spent the last 4 months of her pregnancy on continuous bed rest.
Yeah.
And he's out.
Not, you know, on bed rest.
Not. Well, kind of, but a different kind of bed rest. She then gave birth to twins, Nicholas and Daniel, on June 22nd, 1979. This, though, didn't stabilize Sheila and Colin's relationship. You think it might have? It did not.
No, I would never think it
no,
might.
No, that's true.
That's not what happens.
So I guess it was not long after the twins were born. She was back and they went to a party. I think they were having, Sheila was having a birthday party and Colin left with another woman.
Wow.
During her own birthday party. And she went into a rage. Sheila went into a rage. She smashed a window, cut herself really badly, had to be rushed to the hospital.
Uh-oh.
So that goes on. The couple finally splits in May of 1982 and had shared custody of the twins. So now Neville and June bought a flat for Sheila and the twins in Morris Head Mansions in Maida Vale. That is a very affluent section of West London. Colin lived nearby in Kilburn, also in kind of central West London. So, you know, it's not, I mean, they're sharing custody. They're getting along as well as they can in the circumstances. But Sheila's short-lived modeling career is over now. She's at times on welfare. And other times she's doing just sort of poorly paid temp kind of jobs, short-term kind of jobs. Or she had quit very quickly. She's just aimless. I mean, they got her a house. They're not, I mean, I'm sure the mom and dad were giving her money, but she was just, she was not, she didn't have enough. She's trying to half raise her two twins. Things were not good for her. One of her jobs, as a matter of fact, remember, she has two twins. One of her jobs was at a restaurant in London called School Dinners. The shtick of this thing is they have their servers dressed like schoolgirls, wearing like stockings, I'm sure, and suspenders and very, very short skirts. She did that for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. There's many of those. It reminds me of Hooters, kind of.
Did you look it up to see if it still is in operation today?
I did not. I wouldn't be shocked.
I would be.
She took a cleaning job at one point, and she even at one time posed nude for photographers, but she regretted it and she stopped doing it. But she had done that, and that'll come up in a minute, in a little bit later. Like her mother, Sheila, I'm Australian, it's Sheila in Australia, Sheila had some mental health issues, and her mental health at this point was deteriorating pretty rapidly. Her life was very frustrating. Again, she just didn't know what she's doing with her life. She has these two kids now. She's under a lot of stress. And this starts to impact her mental health. So she started seeing the same psychiatrist that had treated her mother. His name was Dr. Hugh Ferguson. Ferguson diagnosed Sheila as paranoid and possibly psychotic after an initial examination of her. I don't know. I'm sure he was seeing her for a while.
Psychotic?
That's what his initial diagnosis was.
That's not a diagnosis.
Well, he admitted her to St. Andrew's Hospital, which is an expensive private mental health facility in Northampton, north of one, I think like 60 or 70 miles north of London. And Ferguson treated her there. And he fine-tuned his diagnosis and said she had schizoaffective disorder.
Okay.
This was in 1983. So she'd be what, 57, 83? What is she? She's 26 now.
Jeez.
She has twins. She's having mental health problems. She doesn't really have steady work. She was discharged from the hospital in September of that year, of 83. She continued to be treated by Ferguson as an outpatient. He soon decided, I'm going to change it again. I think you're a schizophrenic, a straight up schizophrenic. I don't know what the difference is, to be honest with you.
I mean, I question his skills as a psychiatrist at this point.
Trust me, you're going to be questioning his skills later on, even more so.
She just needed help.
She desperately needed help. Oh, well, this time he did prescribe her antipsychotic medications, though. Now, again, whether she's psychotic and whether this is what she should have prescribed, I don't know.
I'm not a mental health professional, and I've never met this woman, but this doesn't sound right to me.
It doesn't to me.
Probably not the right medication.
No, I wouldn't be. Who knows, but that wouldn't be shocking.
She probably has depression and anxiety because of her life circumstances. Yeah. And needs a good therapist and probably an antidepressant or, you know,
something like that.
Anti-anxiety medication and help with her children, because I'll bet you.
Desperately. Yeah,
dollars
for sure.
To donuts. Colin's not carrying his weight.
No, he is. They have split custody and they have halftime each. He's actually a very good father. Believe it or not. I mean, what? Why are you laughing? I'm confused.
I don't know. Then he's unusual for that time.
No, Carrie. I think all fathers are horrible in the 80s. That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so Sheila's disorder, like her mother, started to take on this overtly religious tone to it. And she became more and more kind of hyper-religious. She talked about having an evil aura. And she thought her setbacks were divine retribution. This reminds me of a past episode a little bit, the 67 Exorcisms of Annalise Michelle, where she inwardly channeled this really overtly religiosity. Sheila came to believe the devil had granted her the power to inject evil into others. So she thought, I'm the evil thing. I deserve this a little bit. But she also had this kind of unhealthy view of her sons and called them the devil's children, much like her mother had called her.
That's a problem.
Yeah. It did kind of focus on her two kids, though. She felt that she could force her children to do evil and even hurt people. And then she would do that. They're 4 years old this time.
I was
going to
say,
they're
tiny.
Four.
Okay.
So she thinks she's going to get them to do evil things, and she can do that. And the devil's giving her that power, and the devil's making her do that.
Yeah.
She openly spoke of suicide at this point, and she also told Dr. Ferguson that she felt capable of harming or even killing her twins.
Yeah.
She told this professional psychiatrist that. Keep that in mind. In March of 1985, Sheila was readmitted to St. Andrews again after she had a complete breakdown. I guess she had like been beating the walls in her house, you know, to where she was injuring herself.
Yeah.
And no one could calm her down. People, friends were there. Her new boyfriend was there. They couldn't calm her down. And she accused them all of meaning her harm and even trying to kill her.
Yeah.
So she goes back to St. Andrews. I'm not sure how long she's there. I don't think very long. When Ferguson discharged her. Oh, I'm sorry. Ferguson discharged her after just 4 weeks. But he did so only on the condition that she would take a monthly injection of an antipsychotic called haloperidol. Apparently, she had not been taking her medication. So he said, this is an injection. You will come into me, and I'll personally give you this injection one time a month. That's it. And you can't not take that medication.
Right.
Otherwise, you don't get out. She agreed to it.
I've never heard of a monthly injection.
I haven't either now.
Huh, that's interesting.
So it's the spring of 1985 now, and by this point, the twins, who are not quite 6 years old, were living pretty much full-time with Colleen and Kilburn because she was just not capable of taking care of them.
Yeah.
Sheila's family began discussing some kind of foster care, too, for the children when they did visit Sheila. So, like, even when she did have, because she still was having them for periods, so they're thinking, well, maybe when you have them, at least for the day, you can put them in foster care. They knew her mental state, and they knew, you know, things could be bad with her having full care of the children. That's what I'm assuming. It sure seems like that because they're saying maybe you should put them in foster care.
Does foster care mean something different than it does here?
I don't know if it meant straight up daycare, but
yeah, maybe.
The term in the sources, they continue to call it foster care. So maybe it does. I don't know. Someone in England, tell us, is that a synonym essentially for daycare?
In that context, it doesn't work.
That seems like daycare.
Yeah.
To us.
Yeah.
It's what it seems like. Because they talked about it during the day, at least during the day, but it could have been even overnight.
Yeah.
Her behavior toward the twins becomes more and more concerning. She had called social services and said she thought she might harm her children. This is at least the second time that she had said that.
This is when Colin needs to go back to court and get their custody order revised.
She had a particular disdain for Daniel, one of the twins, who she felt hated women and was, quote, a potential murderer, end quote.
He's six.
He's 6 years old, and he's your child. Others also noticed Sheila's erratic behavior, naturally. Even a supervisor at a cleaning service that she worked at once in a while said that she would show up to work dirty, poorly dressed, and then spend the entire time she's supposed to be cleaning homes just kind of like spaced out, looking off into individual molecules in the air, not doing anything, and just she's just not all there. One time, she was left alone with her 13-year-old cousin, and she offered the girl drugs because at the time Sheila was dosing herself with cocaine and marijuana, and she offered this kid cocaine and marijuana.
Oh, wow.
And she also, to this 13-year-old cousin, talked openly of committing suicide, and she called herself a, quote, white witch.
Wow.
Yeah. In July of 1985, Sheila, in this mental state, Dr. Ferguson knows what's going on in her world. She still is able to convince him to give her just a half dose of the haloperidol, and that was the last dose that she would have. Now, that's Sheila. Jeremy was the other adopted child of June and Neville Bamber. Jeremy was adopted second. He was adopted by them in January of 1961, about 4 years later. He was about 3 years younger than Sheila. He was a little bit older when he was adopted. This child had been born to a student midwife who had had an affair with a married sergeant in the British Army.
Okay.
So again, that kind of thing, you have to give the kid up for adoption. You can't keep that. The scandal would be way too much. So she gave the baby also to the same Church of England Children's Society that had given Sheila to the Bambers 4 years earlier. Jeremy was adopted when he was, I think, about 6 months old. His childhood, though, with the Bamber family was even more troubled than Sheila's, if that's possible, because he was a troublemaker.
Oh.
He was not a good kid. And they'd send him to prep schools, and he'd get kicked out. And then they finally, at age 9, he was sent to a boarding school. He was bullied there. He did manage to get through high school and returned to home in Essex, where he grew pot behind the cattle shed and had an affair with a much older woman who was a married mother of three.
Oh.
So remember that in country Essex kind of thing? That, oh my God.
Yeah.
Big, big, big scandal. It made them look bad. I mean, they're kind of like gentry of the area, his parents. So this is not the kind of thing they want. Neville paid for Jeremy to go off to Australia and New Zealand, and I guess just like straighten it out and maybe get the hell away from us.
Uh-huh.
And he got into tons of trouble there. He became a thief. He claimed at least that he was dealing heroin. So by 1982, comes back and he works on the family farm for a wage. And I think part of his, you'll see later that his inheritance was incumbent on him working for the farm. So his dad is like, okay, if you're working for me, I'm going to make you work. And if you're not working for me, then, you know, not necessarily you're cut off, but I'm not going to help you as much mm-hmm. anymore. He had a cottage that the family owned. He lived in it on 9 Head Street in Goldhanger. That's a village that's like 3+ miles away from where the White House Farm is in Tollison Darcy. Neville hoped to fill his son with like a purpose. You know, you can get your hands dirty, work hard, make some money. But he still helped him. He gave him a car, for instance, or the use of a car, a family car. And he also gave him an 8% share in one of the family's companies. Not a big company, but like, you know, here's some responsibility. Go do good. Jeremy was not psychotic, but he was not nice. He was arrogant. He was mean. He would taunt his parents. He was reported sometimes he had a bike. He'd ride around his bike around his mother, just like terrorizing her as she's like walking along the farm somewhere. He's just a dick.
Yeah.
He sometimes wore makeup. He maybe did this to anger his parents. At one time, he got a bag of rats and he put it in the car of Barbara Wilson, who was the longtime secretary of the farm. She's like the most devoted employee. He puts a bag of rats. I don't know if they're dead or alive.
Yeah.
He puts that in her car. He was an a-hole.
Yeah.
Jeremy Bamber. Okay. So now it's August of 1985. The Bamber family is, as you can imagine, thoroughly dysfunctional. So none of them get along. But even Jeremy and Sheila, by the way, did not get along. At this point, they're barely on speaking terms.
Oh, brother and sister.
Brother and sister, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the tension's really thick, but still, in August, they decide. So Jeremy lives 3 miles away.
Right.
Sheila's in London. Colin, the father, is going to take the twins on a trip to Norway, a vacation to Norway in like a week or so. So they say, hey, Sheila, why don't you bring the twins and stay here for a few days, maybe a week, and then Colin can drop them off. And Colin can pick him up when he's ready to take them to Norway and just, you know, have some family time.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The boys did not want to go to the farm. They're 6 years old, but they loathe the way June, their grandmother, would just constantly preach them. She made them, like, you know, kneel with her and pray with her and things like that. They did not like her at all. They were very uncomfortable there. They really didn't want to go, and they begged their father, please don't make us go there. But, you know, He's trying to, you know, Sheila's going to be in supervision. This is a good time for them to spend some time with their mother.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the legal situation was. I don't know if he could have said no. I mean, she still had rights. She's still a co-parent at this point.
Yeah.
Colin would later say that as they got to the car, the kids actually begged him, don't make us get out of the car and get in the farm, but he had to. It was August 4th of 1985 is when this happened. Later, the police would find the words, quote, "I hate this place," carved on a cupboard door in the bedroom the twins slept in.
Yeah.
I think cupboard is closet, by the way, in England.
Yeah.
So one of the twins undoubtedly carved that while they were there. On August 6th, Jeremy came to visit the family and spend the evening with his parents, his sister, and his nephews. He would later say that his parents, in his presence that night, broached the topic of the twins being sent, again, to some kind of like a daytime foster care whenever they were in the care
with their mom.
Of their mom. It's not clear if this caused a lot of tension at the time, at least that evening, or if anything was settled or not, but he said the topic was brought up with Sheila that night, August 6th. Jeremy leaves at about 9:30 in the evening. He was seen by a farm worker leaving. June's sister, Pamela Bootflower, we'll hear a lot about the Bootflowers in this, in every episode we'll hear of this story, we'll hear about the Bootflowers. She called the house around 10 p.m.
Wait, this is?
August 6th.
No, whose sister?
This is June's sister.
Okay.
So was the family that owned that land, but,
right.
But June had got it and now married Neville. And the Bootflowers still own some of this stuff there, but the Bambers were much better off than the Bootflowers were.
Okay.
So she calls at about 10 p.m. and she says she spoke with Sheila and then with June. Everything seemed pretty normal. Later, Jeremy would say that he had heard rabbits and seen rabbits around the house. And apparently, so when you saw rabbits, you shot them. So he went and got one of his dad had a couple of rifles. He went and got his father's .22 Anschutz semi-automatic rifle, and he loaded it a full magazine, which is about 10 cartridges. And he went around, scouted around a bit to go shoot some rabbits, but he didn't find any of them and he didn't take any shots. So not long before he left, he'd taken the rifle back. He put it in the kitchen somewhere. Like he thinks maybe in the kitchen table, and continued to spend more of the evening with his parents and just forgot about it. But he realized when he left, he had left a loaded rifle in the kitchen, the kitchen table. By the way, right next to it, a box of ammunition.
Smart.
Yeah. Jeremy would later say that he had not attached a silencer or a telescopic sight that fit the rifle. This is insanely important. Other family members would claim that those objects were typically kept on the rifle even when it was not in use. It was kept in a closet, a gun closet downstairs in the first floor. It's a two-story home. I don't know if I mentioned that. A nephew, one of the Bootflowers, would say that he had seen it just about 2 weeks earlier, and he said the scope and the silencer were on that rifle. Jeremy said his father had removed them sometime in the meantime, and so when we went and got them, there was no scope and no silencer on the rifle.
Okay.
This is incredibly meaningful. This too is meaningful. It will be meaningful. The rifle was also said to be difficult to load. Sometimes that 9th and 10th cartridge took a fair amount of strength to push into the magazine. And remember that 10 bullets max is what the rifle could fire without being reloaded.
Okay.
There are some other things to point out. The White House farm had three telephones on the same landline. One was in the master bedroom upstairs, one was in the kitchen downstairs, and one was in the first floor office. If something bad happened at the White House farm, there were plenty of options to call for help. And then something bad happened at the White House farm. So, triggerish warning here as well. Again, it's going to be, assume, if you're really squeamish about terrible things happening, you probably shouldn't listen to these episodes on this. So
does that include me?
No, it does not. You don't have a choice. I'm sorry. I could sit here and pretend to talk to you.
Yeah.
And I could talk. I could use your voice. God, that's fascinating. You tell a great story, Dean. There's some confusion about how many calls came into the local police about a dangerous situation brewing at the White House farm that early morning of August 7th. But it is certain that Jeremy Bamber called the Chelmsford Police Station not 999, which is their 911 in England, but he called directly into the station line. He did made this call at 3:26 a.m., now August 7th. Jeremy said he's worried. His father had just called him a little while ago and told him that Sheila had, quote, gone berserk and was threatening he and June, his parents, with the rifle that Jeremy had left on the kitchen table.
Okay.
Then the line seemed to cut mid-sentence. So Jeremy calls the police. He begs them, can you send someone to the house and see what's going on? A British telecom operator would check the line to the White House farm to see if it was operational. This was done at 3:56 a.m. and then again at 4:30 in the morning. And the line not only worked, but it was actually open. So Neville had not been, had not cut off in mid-sentence by hanging up the phone. He had what? We don't know.
Dropped
the phone.
It
had knocked out of his hand. We don't know. So that line is still open. In fact, she said, I can hear some noises in the background. At least I can hear a dog barking, and she could listen in at the time. She only mentions this dog barking, which also could be very important too. You know, that's 3:56 and 4:30. As police cars were dispatched from the Witham police station, Jeremy also began driving to his family home. Remember, he doesn't live very far away.
Right.
The squad cars actually passed Jeremy driving very slowly along Page's Lane. And they had got to the farmhouse about 1 or 2 minutes before Jeremy. I looked it up, and they would have been a significantly longer drive than him.
Yeah.
It was now almost 4 a.m. when the police squad cars rolled up outside the White House farmhouse, and they stopped in the driveway. It's along a road, and it's but it's not right on the road. It's back behind. There's some trees screening it, too. Again, it's a big two-story Georgian house. It's a large house. I wouldn't call it like a big mansion, but it's a large house. Jeremy got out of his car, and he walked over to police officers, and they asked him to follow them around kind of a bend and some trees that hid the house from the street. Like, come with us. We're going to go around here. They essentially didn't want to approach it straight on front door.
Yeah.
So he had told them, I'm sure, that there was a rifle and that his father had said his sister was going berserk.
Right.
In the dark, it's dark now still, the little group kind of stole around the trees, and they came to the back of the house. They saw lights in the kitchen window, what Jeremy identified as a bathroom, and then also upstairs in the bedroom where he believed the twins, Daniel and Nicholas, were hopefully asleep, their bedroom. He saw lights there. So they drew up close to the house as they dared, but they heard nothing but the soft whimpering of the family dog. So they're at the back of the house. They hear the dog whimpering. They see some lights on. They start creeping around to the front of the house. They're very careful. They don't know what's happening. Jeremy and the officers, they at the front, they see a light shining from the master bedroom upstairs. And somebody in that little group said they saw a shadow cross by the window. So the group frantically ducks down. They I guess, scramble behind a nearby hedge, thinking there could be rifle fire any second here.
Do they have guns?
No, they are not. This is England. They are unarmed.
Yeah.
They're worried still. So they retreat back to the police cars and they call for backup. You know, they're thinking, look, this could be like an active shooter situation now. And this is a big farmhouse. We need help. The officers, as I said, were unarmed. So the police would need to dispatch an armed response team.
Yeah.
And man, this is past 4 a.m. Jeremy was agonizing. He told the officers about the, I guess he reminded, he must have told them before this about the 22 Anschluss rifle that he had loaded and left on the kitchen table. He also said, you know, his father's call sounded very ominous, so he's begging them, please go check on my family. Quote, they're all the family I've got, he told them. Jeremy particularly fretted about his sister. He said he hoped Sheila, quote, hadn't done anything silly. When the police asked him why his sister might have gone berserk, Jeremy answered, I don't really know. She's a nutter. She's been having treatment. Jeremy mentioned she had some experience with guns years before. Had gone target shooting a couple times when they were teenagers. So she did have some experience with guns, he told the police.
Yeah.
That also has become a bone of contention. So that's why I'm giving this kind of detail. I'm trying to, these things are going to come back.
Uh-huh.
It's not until 5 a.m. when the armed response team finally got to the farmhouse. They had to wake people up. Get them dressed. they set up a base in a barn behind the house, in the back of the house, and Jeremy came with them to that barn, and then they waited and waited and waited. Occasionally, officers would shout through a bullhorn for Sheila to come out, you know, put your hands up.
Yeah.
We have the house surrounded. Please come out. The usual stuff.
Yeah.
No response whatsoever, other than the occasional yaps of the little dog. I think it was just Shih Tzu owned by June.
Yeah.
That's all they heard. No voice, nothing else. But still they waited until dawn finally rose at 7:30 a.m., which doesn't sound right. I mean, this is August. Shouldn't it be much earlier than that? I'm not sure. But that's what the sources I read said, that you know, light broke at 7:30 in the morning.
Wait, and they're not hearing anything like gunshots or anything?
They're not.
They're hearing and seeing nothing.
I don't think they're super close, but they don't hear that. But they're hearing the dog bark.
You'd hear a gunshot.
You'd think.
Yeah, okay.
But that's going to also be weird and controversial.
Okay.
So it's 2.5 hours about after they've arrived, 3.5 hours after the police first got the call, and more than 4 hours after Jeremy's first frantic call from Neville, his dad. Yeah. So it took a very long time for them to truly do something. So the team moves around the perimeter of the house. One officer thought he saw a woman's body on the kitchen floor. He was able to look through a window, but he knew they'd have to enter the home to really know what's going on and see things better and figure out what's happening in there. It was not until 7:54 in the morning when the police finally slammed through the back door using a sledgehammer. The key that had locked the door was found still in the lock on the other side as they broke in. The team scrambles through the house, you know. I'm sure they're doing hand signals and all that kind of a thing. They fan out and they begin discovering, trigger warning, bodies.
Yeah.
They found Neville first. He was dead, laying over a fallen chair in the kitchen. Apparently that must have been what the officer had seen, thought it was a woman's body, but it wasn't. It was Neville.
Yeah.
He was wearing pajamas that had fallen around his knees. His face was lying in a coal scuttle on the floor. I guess the wall of it's like a, you know, little brass thing that you keep coal in.
Yeah.
In 1985, I didn't know they used coal, but apparently they were still using coal. Blood and brain matter had settled over the kitchen floor from a multiple head wounds. He'd been shot in the shoulder and the arm as well. 6 bullets to his head.
Wow.
Had killed him. He was shot 8 times. Most of the shots had been fired at very close range. Some of them were like scalp wounds and things like that. The shots to the body, though, seemed to be from a little further away, about 2 feet or so, but the shots to the head seemed to be from fairly close distance. This suggested that the shots to the body had been first,
right,
and the more lethal headshots had been after he was injured already. There was broken crockery and fallen furniture, which indicated to police that there had been some kind of a fight, some kind of a battle had gone on. The placement of the spent cartridges was even more suggestive. So there were some cartridges on the stairs, and there were some cartridges on the kitchen, indicating that the attack had happened in 2 places and likely had ended in the kitchen and started somewhere upstairs.
Yeah.
The spent shells up in the master bedroom itself indicated he had been shot, would think later, theorize later, 4 times upstairs in his room before, and at some point he had struggled downstairs to face his assailant. Assailant? Assailant.
Assailant.
You don't like a assailant? Can I say
assailant?
That over again? I'm going to say it over again. To face his assailant. It was a pretty remarkable feat of strength and determination. So he had a couple of he had body shots. He had headshots. The headshots obviously weren't lethal. Like I said, some of the headshots, they weren't like right through the brain matter kind of a thing, right?
There right.
was clearly, it was frantic. It seemed so anyway. But still, shot 4 times upstairs. He had got his way downstairs and appeared to have done battle with his attacker downstairs. Injuries to his arms and to his head that were not bullet wounds, but other kinds of injuries to his head indicated that he had been struck repeatedly by very likely the rifle before finally being dispatched with the last shots to his head. And those had killed him.
Okay.
His injuries were really severe, though. He had a fractured jaw. His mouth was just a mess, a wreck. He'd been shot. Again, so the headshots were to, like, the jaw and face area, not brain matter. He would not have been able to have any kind of speech. He couldn't have talked, given his injuries at that point. His nose was broken. He had black eyes. He had cuts to his face and head and his wrist, too. And there were 3 circular burns on his back, I'm not sure. And I still don't know what those indicate. But he had put up a fight for sure. There was a battle.
And how old was he at the time?
He was, I think I said 24. So he was about 61. He was pretty fit.
Yeah.
But remember, he was also shot multiple times upstairs. So the police moved upstairs. Now they only found his body, Neville's body downstairs. They whisper, you know, they're doing the typical whispering and communication with one another. And with, and they're, you know, trying to be very quiet as they can. So an officer gets up there and he uses a mirror on a stick to view the landing of the staircase.
Uh-huh.
And that's clear. So they go up, they creep up the stairs, and they did the same thing from the hallway. They used the same mirror stick to view into the master bedroom where the door was open.
Yeah.
That's where they first found a woman in her nightgown splayed across the doorway just inside the room. It was the first thing they saw. Blood everywhere. That was June, Jeremy's mother. She had been shot 6 times around her head area, in her neck, in her chest, in her arms. A 7th and final bullet had pierced her head right between her eyes.
Wow.
That shot had been fired from about 1 foot away. Crispy, the little Shih Tzu, was shivering under the bed, whimpering.
Aww.
So they rescued Crispy. That's the dog that had been doing the yapping. That's the only noises they had heard for many hours now. So the police group moves into the room, and they immediately find a third body. It is Sheila. She was on her back in a turquoise nightgown. Her feet were bare. The 22 Anschutz rifle lay across her body, fingers along the trigger, the barrel aimed up at her face where the fatal shot had pierced her chin and gone into her brain. Next to her body was the family Bible. It was smeared with blood and it lay open, whether by design or at random, I don't know, but it lay open to Psalms 51:55, quote, "Save me from blood guiltiness," unquote. And that phrase was underlined with a streak of bright red blood in the Bible right next to her body.
That seems very performative or theatrical.
It does.
Staged?
It could be both, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Sheila had been shot twice, though, but the first wound had gone in below her jaw into her throat and had been fired with the end of the rifle about maybe 3 inches away from the wound, from the flesh. That had not killed her. And forensic specialists or doctors would say it maybe eventually it would have, but she wouldn't be able to move and walk around after that injury. The kill shot had gone through her chin into her head, as I mentioned, and that had been a contact wound. So the first shot from a little bit away, the second shot, and it didn't kill her, the second shot right against her bottom of her chin. She would have died instantly from that second shot, of course.
Right.
A coroner later testified that Sheila, again, could have been mobile after the first shot, but this was unlikely given the blood pattern on her nightgown. He felt that she had been lying there for both shots.
Okay.
Whether she did it herself or someone else did it to her, he didn't say. But she's probably sitting up and first the shot from a little 3 inches away and then the shot directly under her chin that killed her. There were no marks on her body to indicate she'd been in any kind of a fight. Her feet and hands also seemed very clean. There was a little bit of blood on the back of her right hand. And her fingers were, there's a little bit of a contention here as well, but they're supposedly pretty free of like powder, you know, residue that you traditionally think about, that is from people firing a weapon.
Yeah.
The officers made their way to the bedroom where the twins should be. Huge trigger warning here. I'm not going to belabor this. I'll give you enough information that I think is necessary for you to understand the case as well as you can and what happened on that horrific early morning. But Daniel lay in bed, curled up on his side. Nicholas was in bed on his back. Daniel had been shot 5 times through the back of his head. Nicholas had been shot 3 times into his face. Both of the kids were dead. While officers radioed in this just awful news to the station, one of the officers made his way outside where Jeremy was waiting in his car, I believe, and he told him what happened. And the officer tapped on the window and said, "I'm really sorry, Jeremy, but we found everybody dead." Bamber started to cry. Jeremy did. He said, quote, "You said everything would be all right." And the officer sat down beside him and said, "I know. We like to think things will work out." So he'd done something police officers would never do, was promise things are going to be okay. Jeremy seemed lost. He seemed confused. He was probably in some kind of state of shock, I imagine. He got out of the car, and he either retched or actually full-on vomited. A few minutes later, he asked if he could talk to his father and had to be sort of gently reminded, no, we just told you, everyone died. Your father is dead. And he started to cry again. It was almost like he had difficulty understanding what had happened and that what had happened had really happened.
Which is understandable.
Yeah.
Unless, am I allowed to say what I think happened?
No.
Okay.
We're going to go into that in depth. Let's wait until the end because there's a lot more to the story. You actually, I would advise everyone there to withhold what you think's happened. Try to listen to the evidence. This is one of those stories you might go back and forth. So Jeremy told the officer, quote, Sheila ought to be in a nut house for what she's done. Again, as if he forgot she's dead too there. So he's very confused. Detective Chief Inspector Taft Jones was in charge of the scene. He would be in charge of the investigation, at least initially. He scoured the house for clues, he and his team. They were trying to gain any sense of what happened, what was the sequence of events. The house was locked up securely from the inside. The police surgeon on the scene agreed with Jones that it appeared to be a mass killing. Sheila had killed everyone else and then had shot herself with the same Anschutz rifle. I mean, to them, it was obvious. This was pretty much an open and shut case. This was a horrible, horrible mass murder and suicide. So the story comes out the next morning. It utterly shocks the nation. The local countryside, especially around Tolleset Darcy, was just devastated, just completely stunned. This is like their leading family.
Yeah.
The Bambers, they're kind of thought of as bigwigs. And they're very well known. Everybody knew them. Especially Neville was very well regarded. So there's headlines like Farmhouse of Death. And the newspapers wrote a lot about Sheila, her modeling name Bambi. I guess that sold newspapers. And the other kind of would focus on that staid and staunchly conservative former fighter pilot Neville. He was a kind of a dashing figure as well. So it was instantly a notorious crime. Newspaper coverage soon revealed that Jeremy and Sheila had been adopted. And this, by the way, was not generally known outside of the family and their immediate friends.
Yeah.
So that became kind of public knowledge here during this post-murder coverage. It further came out that Sheila's biological mother was the daughter of a chaplain who had been part of Queen Elizabeth's coronation, and that Jeremy's biological father had these kind of royal connections as well, because he was a senior official at Buckingham Palace. So just imagine, this just, you know, now the story goes to 11.
Yeah.
The farmhouse also had some secrets that the media covered. The occupants just before the Bambers had one family member drown himself in a water tank, and that family member's father had killed himself by drinking poison in his bedroom. So the public is just eating this stuff up.
Yeah.
Okay. So the investigation is going to begin now. And from the police perspective, like I said, it was almost like a boring case. It was very clear to them what had happened. It was not really controversial at all or didn't seem very mysterious. It was this atrocious murder-suicide. Taft Jones didn't even bother to secure the scene for that kind of intense forensic investigation that you would think of as these unsolved murders, because there seemed to him to be no real need. And so a lot of the evidence that could have been evidence was not maybe carefully recorded and gathered.
What year is it?
1985.
Okay.
I mean, they have, you know, not as intense as they do now, forensic units, but they still had those guys in, I don't know if they're in white suits and booties, but they had that kind of technology, and they would do that kind of procedure in that process. Some items were handled without even wearing gloves, including the murder weapon, the rifle itself.
That's just dumb.
That is dumb. Detective Inspector Ron Cook, he was one of the lead crime scene officers, and according to his deputy, Detective Sergeant Neil Davison, he picked up the Bible next to Sheila without gloves on and started rifling through it. And suddenly the two men looked at each other, and Cook was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
I just screwed up big time. And in fact, Davison would call it later an oh shit moment. Cook asked his deputy Davidson, what page was it on, do you think?
Oh,
and so he turned back to that page that they thought it had been on and laid it next to Sheila and then took pictures as if nothing had been interfered with, like this is crime scene pictures, and it wasn't anymore. So it's not clear if the Bible had been found on her or to the side of her. I believe it was found to the side of her. In fact, Cook's nickname among his fellow officers was Bumbling Ron.
Yeah.
So by all means, have him at the murder scene. The Bible was not fingerprinted or otherwise examined. Items like a hacksaw blade that were used apparently to get into the house were simply just left behind by police, and they'd be found months later in the grass by farm workers. Officers didn't take notes at the time. They're speaking to Jeremy, they weren't really taking notes. In fact, they had to reconstruct those conversations weeks later when it became more controversial.
Yeah.
Jeremy's clothes were not examined, or they didn't ask for them at the time at all.
Mm-hmm.
They'd get them from him weeks later as well. 2 days after the event, the police simply tossed the bloody mattresses from the upstairs bedroom to be burned.
Wow.
Theoretically, that could be vital evidence.
Yeah.
The same was true for the bedding, the carpets. They just tossed them out and burned them. The bodies were almost immediately released to be cremated. The next day, the police returned the keys to the house to Jeremy and another set to the family, to the Boot Flowers as well, by the way. So the next day, that that same morning, effectively, that crime scene, theoretically, was
done.
Not secure.
Yeah.
But the case was effectively closed until it wasn't. There were some loose ends. One of the most troublesome was the silencer that had, again, some family members said, been normally kept affixed to the rifle. It was not on the rifle that was laying across Sheila's body. This would later, again, be of immense importance, since authorities would argue that with a silencer in place, Sheila simply did not have the physical reach to have shot herself the way it appeared she had. If that silencer is on, Sheila was murdered.
Okay.
The rifle and the silencer, as well as the scope, were normally kept, as I mentioned, in a gun cupboard. The police claimed to have searched that cupboard day of. 3 days later, with the house keys that had been returned to them, a cousin of Jeremy's named David Bootflower would enter the house and find the silencer in the cupboard. What's more, he said he saw flecks of red on the end of the silencer that he thought might be blood. And then some other red spots that he thought on top of the silencer that he thought might be paint from the mantelpiece or the hearth above the first floor fireplace.
Uh-huh.
So naturally, what did he do with that silencer?
Clean it. Wipe it off.
Well, naturally, Carrie, don't be so sarcastic. You ruined my... you're supposed to give me the straight... Carrie, you're the straight man.
I mean, I was being
straight.
He would
take it to the police. Right? Naturally, oh my God, we found the silencer. We're going to take this to the police.
Of course you should.
Of course you should.
I'm just assuming the right thing isn't being done.
For sure. He took it home. Took it home back to the Bootflower house.
Why?
Where the family examined the silencer and thought that they saw evidence that it had been damaged. So the Bootflowers would tell the police of their find. The police would then wait 2 days more until August 12th, some sources say the 13th, to go and fetch the potentially critical piece of evidence. So it was found 3 days later. The police 2 days after that didn't come get it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it had been for 2 days in the custody of this family that, as we'll find, has some questions.
Yeah.
But wait, you ask, who were the Bootflowers and why were they gathering and handling evidence from the scene of the crime? In this case, that's critical. They were everything. Without their involvement, this case is really sort of a tragedy. It's more a tragedy than it is a crime. After the Bootflowers got their way, though, it would turn into what it is now, which is this kind of enduring mystery, this this amazing whodunit that we don't have a full answer to, and it would turn into a crime and kind of a trial of the century we'll talk about in a little while. But first, let's get to know the Bootflowers a little better.
They have a great name.
They do have a great name. The Bootflowers. Though it was David Bootflower who found the silencer, it was his sister Ann Eaton who kind of became the main driver of what the Bootflowers were able to do. Ann was Jeremy's 35-year-old cousin. She was the daughter of June. I'm sorry. She was the daughter of June's sister, Pamela. So she was, again, that was the family that kind of had owned everything that Neville had married into and took over that very profitable farm.
Right.
So Anne heard about the murders the next day. She rushes to the house, and she finds Jeremy there talking to the police. So she starts comforting. She sits next to Jeremy on the sofa. They had been kind of a long-term strained relationship with the Bootflowers, between the Bootflowers, and especially Jeremy and Sheila. But still, this is family. She's comforting him. She's holding his hand. He's distraught. He's talking to the police. Jeremy is. So Anne is trying to comfort him. Historically, they hadn't really liked, they thought he was weird.
Yeah.
You know, the makeup and things like that, they thought he was kind of effeminate. He was odd to them. Jeremy even described himself as being, quote, a bit velvet. And again, he sometimes wore the makeup. He just kind of rubbed the local conservative countryside the wrong way. And the Bootflowers were exactly that kind of folk.
Yeah.
But worse yet, Jeremy, like Sheila, didn't get along with June, their mother, who was the actual biological family member of the Bootflowers and the Eatons. And so they, you know, they took her side. They took Aunt June's side against the kids, right?
Right.
She was kind of dear Aunt June to them. And there was Jeremy's kind of earlier wayward ways, his possible criminal activity in Australia, the families, though, they did share ownership of a key asset. It's called the OC Road Vacation Park, and had earlier been burgled of about £1,000 earlier that year. The Bootflowers suspected Jeremy had done it. So there's a lot of strain going on here. But there's Anne. She's holding Jeremy's hand. She's next to him on the sofa. And he's describing as he loaded the rifle after thinking he heard rabbits, and then how he left it on the kitchen before he left. When Jeremy started describing June's religious zealotry, though, and her bouts with mental illness, including he mentioned her hospitalization and her electroshock therapy, Anne starts to get pissed off. He thinks she's, quote, screwing Aunt Jane into the ground, unquote. So she's starting to get angry that he's kind of revealing family secrets.
Right.
Skeletons in their closet. During this questioning, Julia Mugford, another name to remember, another great name, by the way, she's Jeremy's on-again, off-again girlfriend. She stops by as well. She told the police how Jeremy had called her about like 3-ish in the morning that evening. He said, quote, there's something wrong at home, unquote, and that he told her he had called the police and was heading over to the farmhouse now. So it should have been the discrepancy when that was. That seems like that should have been about 3:30. It may have been earlier than that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the evidence is like it's not clear. The records weren't kept. You'll find, I'll mention later, but British Telecom did not log any local calls. So we don't know when calls were made and to where with any certainty, with any actual physical record of it.
So they didn't get a phone bill with itemized phone
not
calls?
Not local calls.
Like we did?
Only long distance calls, yep.
Well, we got local calls, didn't
well,
we?
Well, they did not. Huh. I don't think so. I don't know. Anne thought that was odd how he had called Julia Mugford, you know, his girlfriend. So Anne's getting weirded out by this. When Jeremy, she thought Jeremy wasted time calling his girlfriend instead of rushing straight to the farmhouse.
Yeah, it took him a while to get 3 miles.
It did. Anne would later say, I became puzzled, more puzzled, then suspicious of Jeremy, and then bloody suspicious of Jeremy, end quote. She even started surreptitiously recording. She found like a bit of a paper in her purse, I guess, and she started taking notes while he's being interviewed by the police.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Almost immediately, the Bootflowers, as a family, started to suspect Jeremy.
Yeah.
Anne probably went home and said, oh my God, here's what's going on. Jeremy had always, you know, kind of loved the good life and had been reined in, he felt, by his very staid father. So they're thinking right away, oh my God, he murdered the whole family to get the money. Soon after, he told the Bootflowers that he would have to start selling assets due to inheritance taxes that he was incurring.
Yeah.
They were even more mortified. So they're becoming highly suspicious of him. They're becoming angry toward him as well.
Yeah.
Anne's father, Robert Bootflower, he was absolutely certain from early on. He thought, quote, Jeremy had shot the family and tried to put the blame on Sheila.
Yeah.
End quote. He thought Sheila was just too flighty and she's too weak. She would not have committed this kind of an act. So it was the Bootflowers who drew police attention to the silencer. They're the ones who said, hey, this was always attached to the rifle. They figured out the rifle would have been too long for Sheila to commit suicide with the silencer on, and they told the police that. Their conclusion was that Jeremy realized this, and so he removed the silencer, and then he, quote, hiding it, end quote, in the cupboard. You know, the gun cupboard where it was always kept.
Yeah.
But that was their theory. So he had realized this after he had shot her with the silencer on.
Right.
And realized, oh, no, that's not going to pan out, so I'm gonna you know, unscrew, take off the silencer, and then put it back in the gun cupboard. But the family was not open. The Bootflowers were not open about this to Jeremy. So they're doing this behind his back.
Well, of course.
Yeah, I know. Anne actually said she feared that he might harm them if he knew that they suspected him. Both she and her father wrote about the case copiously in their diaries. It was obsession of theirs. One of Anne's entries said, quote, "It was a frightening moment. We all became extremely worried that Jeremy might realize we suspected him and come after us," end quote. So they have these fears and suspicions, and some of the family members went to the police and they asked for an audience with lead investigator, Detective Taft Jones. So they went to him, they talked to him, they explained why they felt Sheila was framed.
Yeah.
They talked about the oddness of the missing silencer and how that, you know, that was always on there. And they even said what they believed was Jeremy's motive, which was to get all the money. And he was this, you know, this greedy little do-nothing kind of a guy.
Yeah.
Jones thought they were completely full of shit. He actually finally cut off the meeting by standing up from his desk and shouting, "I can't put up with this, all this nonsense." And he booted them from his office.
Huh.
Anne would later in her diary call him a, quote, "raving Red Bull."
Whatever that is.
I don't know. I don't know if he had red hair. I have no idea. Anne then went over to the farmhouse and she found Jeremy there again. He's living there apparently, or he's there a lot.
Yeah.
He was crying. So she starts comforting him again. And this time though, she secretly examines his arms for any marks of a fight. And Jeremy there was telling her, "I can't stand to live here anymore. I got to go. I'm going to leave the farmhouse. I don't want to come back here." So graciously, Anne said, "Okay, you can leave the keys with me." And he did. He gave her the keys to the farmhouse. I think they had their own keys. I'm not completely clear. So the next morning, Anne goes back to the farmhouse and she starts hunting for clues. And Jeremy, she thinks Jeremy could have left through the kitchen window. Apparently had a locking mechanism that was, was iffy. So she thought, okay, he could have, because remember the house was completely locked up from the inside. She thought he could have gone out that kitchen window and slammed it shut in a way that would have appeared locked. So she's developing that kind of a theory.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, she's got to find a way for someone to get in and out of there. And that would also make it look, locking up the rest of the house. She thought, okay, that was his way of making it look like Sheila did it. It had to be an inside job.
Right.
Her father came over later that day, Robert, and Anne and Robert decided that the Bamber valuables were not going to be safe there in the farmhouse. So they thought, we better take them for safekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
So they started gathering all of June's jewelry, and they even checked Neville's clothes for cash. They're going to take that too for safekeeping.
Jeez.
Brother David Bootflower, Anne's brother, came over. And he took the guns that remained in the house. He took them away. This, by the way, was when he found that missing silencer. So this is 3 days after the event.
Okay.
And he's rummaging in the gun cupboard, which is situated kind of beneath the staircase on the first floor.
So hang on.
Yeah.
They had the conversation with the head detective before they found the silencer.
That's how I read
okay.
it. I
thought it was
flippity-flop. You know, I'm not clear. It could have been just written poorly. That it seems more likely that conversation with Taft Jones would have been after the silencer. I'm not clear. Honestly,
okay.
I read and reread it. I'm not super clear.
Okay.
I need a timeline. My sources didn't have timelines. This is why timelines are so important, Carrie.
Okay.
So, and one of the main sources on this is a phenomenal article in the New Yorker by Heidi Blake that recently came out. Strongly urge you. We'll get into the court case a little bit, and it's going to go over a lot of stuff we're not going to go over, but it's very good journalism. So,
how good can it be if the timeline's not clear?
That's true. Maybe I just didn't read it. It's not. I'm not going to blame Heidi. I probably didn't read it right. So
I'm just kidding, Heidi.
You better be. I'm on team Heidi. So, David said that the silencer stuck out from an ammunition box that had hundreds of rounds in it in that gun cupboard. So he would have, you know, in their theory, he would have just tossed it back into the gun cupboard in this ammo box.
Yeah.
And that's when they noticed they had red marks. They said they noticed it right away. They blood, paint, they didn't know. But, you know, that's when they said, we need to take the silencer back with us and take a closer look at it. So the Boot Flyers ran into a dead end, though, with Detective Jones, right? He said, nope, I think you're full of crap. This is a murder-suicide. Leave my office.
He's not very open-minded.
Yeah, well, he'd been at the scene for a very long period of time, and he had been the lead investigator at the scene itself. The Boot Flyers, though, found an ally in Detective Sergeant Stan Jones. He, no relation, by the way, to Taff Jones. And I think it's just that in England, every third person is named Jones.
Probably,
I believe
yeah.
that's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. So Anne had kind of tested the waters with Stan Jones at the farmhouse when he was there. And Stan Jones had responded with complete agreement. Quote, I was looking for something to go and arrest Bamber for, he said.
Yeah.
So he had already apparently suspected Jeremy. And when Anne says, here's what we think happened, he was like, all right, we've got this. So Stan Jones goes to Anne's house and there at her house examines the silencer. And again, I guess that was 2 days later. They showed him what they thought was blood on the silencer. And he agreed, I think that's blood too. He also saw another fleck of red that he felt had come from the mantle. I don't know if they put that in his head or if he got that idea, but they thought, again, this came from that hearth in the kitchen at the farmhouse. He thought, okay, so you know what happened here? This must have been struggling. They knew that Neville and his attacker had struggled. They were struggling over the rifle and had knocked against the silencer, end of it, had knocked against the hearth and got chipped, you know, some red paint on that silencer. I don't know why they wouldn't think they're both blood spots, but that's what they said. He said he thought that right away. This is blood, that's paint.
Right.
The Boot Flyers were overjoyed. You know, maybe they could finally stop Jeremy from getting away with murder after all. If he was the killer, he didn't deserve the £400,000 Bamber estate, they felt. Mm-hmm. Neville and June's will left everything to their two adopted children. Mm-hmm. So now Jeremy would get everything. It would later be alleged that June had been considering cutting Jeremy out of the will. So now he would get it all. And remember how worried the Boot Flyers were when they heard Jeremy was going to sell assets to cover inheritance taxes? Many of those assets had come from their side of the family or sort of belonged, or not belonged, but they were used by their side of the family.
Yeah.
Some property they either lived in or wanted to live in was included in those assets he was talking about selling. So if Jeremy now was convicted of murder, he would lose everything and the Boot Flyers would get back what was rightfully theirs.
Yeah.
But, you know, they weren't done. So, you know, they'd given they'd got Stan Jones on their side. They'd give him the silencer. But with Jeremy away from the farmhouse, they had the place all to themselves. So when Jeremy was off, like, fine dining with his girlfriend or going on a windsurfing trip or going on another trip to Amsterdam to buy weed, the Boot Flyers were going to the house in search for more clues. I'm being a little sarcastic. There I am. Jeremy, in no case, will ever help himself in this. He was acting amazingly stupidly. So they tested the theory that Jeremy had exited through the kitchen window over the sink and closed it behind him, and they thought they found it was plausible. So they're like trying to reenact. They are literally acting like cops at this point. And it's like, I don't know if he could lock it. Was it locked? I'm not clear on that. There's some uncertainty about that, but they felt that it could have looked like it appeared to the police on the morning by Jeremy going out that window.
Yeah.
While Anne was searching the yard around the farmhouse, she learned from a farm worker that June had bought a bicycle not all that long ago. She didn't see it there, so she wondered. So she naturally went to Jeremy's house while he was away on one of his trips, his cottage, and there she found the bike leaning against an outside wall. So this kind of gave rise to a new detail in their theory. Jeremy, they figured, must have borrowed his mom's bicycle and used it to sneak back to the house. So remember, he lived a few miles away.
Yeah.
That's not a walk. And they thought he used the bicycle to like go in the, you know, farm byways and avoid any real roads and big roads and sneak back into the house at, you know, 2 in the morning, whatever.
Yeah.
And do the deed. and then returning home again on the bicycle.
That doesn't even seem all that necessary.
Well, I think they thought that this way he couldn't be seen in his car, like driving to the scene, that no one could see his car and attach it to, hey, you're heading back toward the farmhouse before you called them. So they thought he did this. He used a bicycle and drove on a route that would almost certainly not be seen by anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Her father, Robert, was wandering through the field and the trails and byways in the area to seek the likeliest route. So he started Robert Bootflower tried to find that. He's like wandering all over the place, trying to find Jeremy's most likely route to have gone back to the house and murdered his family. He and his daughter started developing this elaborate theory, and they wrote about it in their diaries. And just, I mean, they started adding speculations and almost treating them like certainties. Robert's theorizing was very elaborate. He wrote like a bad true crime potboiler. He wrote how Jeremy rode in silence beneath the moonlight, crept up to the house, got the rifle, murdered his family, fought with his injured father in the kitchen, and scratched the silencer on the red painted mantelpiece during that fight. The multiple shots for each victim was, quote, to make it look like the work of a maniac, end quote. That's what Robert wrote and thought.
Yeah.
Robert wrote about how Jeremy had to awaken the still sleeping Sheila, and by saying, wake up, Sheila, he imagines Jeremy saying to her, mommy wants you to say prayers with her. He writes this. He's giving dialogue to Jeremy's murder spree in his diary. He had this, you know, the sleepy sister, Sheila, go to the master bedroom and where she laid down so Jeremy could shoot her. Quote, he has Jeremy saying this, quote, lie down here, darling, put the Bible on your chest, end quote. He has Jeremy saying that and Sheila obeying. He then shot her and escaped through the kitchen window and, you know, madly pedals home to call the police and start the whole charade. Robert wrote, quote, I am convinced that Jeremy has sold his soul to the devil, end quote. This theory begins to take hold within large parts of the local police force. He's communicating it to them. So is Anne.
Yeah.
A junior detective named Mick Barlow totally bought into it. The Bootflower's telling this theory. He goes, you guys have nailed it. This is what happened. He had been at the funeral for the family, and he had thought that Jeremy had used makeup to go to the funeral to, quote, give others the impression he was looking drawn and emotional, end quote. So he's super suspicious. Everything Jeremy does to him is suspicious. Barlow began updating the Bootflowers with information that the police were digging up as they're gathering some information, which he should not be doing.
Yeah, no.
He listens to their theories. He went and himself and he tested the kitchen window and he thought, it could be closed from the outside. He went to Jeremy's house to see this bicycle for himself, which was there. Not realizing or maybe not caring that the bicycle's presence as, quote, evidence was entirely based on the Bootflower story of what they felt happened. So he's like going to, instead, oh, there's the bicycle. Okay, another nail in the coffin.
Yeah.
That bicycle is only important solely based on these speculations of the Bootflower family. I mean, Taft Jones learned of this, put a stop to it. He said, no more of this stuff. Knock that off.
Yeah.
This case is effectively closed. The Bootflowers complained to the chief constable of the Essex police, and they were able to get a high-level review of the evidence. He's like, okay. We'll take a look at it. We'll have people above Taft Jones take a look at it, and we'll decide if we think it's murder-suicide or it's worth investigating as a murder case.
Yeah.
The review came to the same verdict that Taft Jones and the initial investigators had already come to. Sheila had killed her family, then she had killed herself. All of the evidence was very clear to them as well. The Bootflowers had made their play, but they'd come up short. Their cousin, the killer Jeremy, would get away with mass murder and live easy off the entire Bamber fortune for the rest of his life. Doubt had been sown, but legally, the case was over until it wasn't. And we will take that up in part two of the White House Farm Murders episode. So we'll probably have a little recap, but it won't be that much. So please, if you're... wait, this is the end of part one, so it doesn't make any sense. But I'll remind you to listen to part one at the beginning of part two. But we will get into it then. We're going to talk about Julia Mugford, this girlfriend of Jeremy's, who will wind up being very important, will follow the rest of the investigation, which will now be a murder investigation, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And then the trial and so on.
Okie dokes. Yeah, so, I got my own opinions.
Do you?
Yep.
Okay. Like I said, this is one of those things, your opinions might shift on this kind of a thing. We'll see. Okay? All right.
Okay.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening. And see you next week.
I'm not going to say anything.